Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Later in the program, we'll discuss the decision by the Trump administration to open more oil and gas drilling across Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, sparking widespread criticism from environmental conservation groups. But first, we're going to discuss the growing Rights of Nature social movement. Proponents have been working to fundamentally redefine our relationship with nature. And in recent years, a number of scientists are joining this movement by backing laws recognizing that nature has inherent rights and intrinsic value. In her recent piece in Inside Climate News, our guest today, Katie Surma, writes, "As scientists have flocked to the movement in recent years, they've given it a new layer of credibility and enforceability. They're helping to craft laws rooted in scientific principles, collaborating with local communities to collect evidence for court cases, and drawing on fields like ecology and neuroscience to provide a scientific basis for the movement's core philosophies, ideas that indigenous peoples have already validated through centuries of territorial stewardship." So what are the rights of nature? Why does it matter for us to rethink our relationship with the natural environment? Well, joining us to discuss, we're very pleased to have Katie Surma, reporter at Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization dedicated to covering climate change, energy, and the environment. Katie's reporting focuses on international environmental law, human rights, and environmental justice. Katie, good to have you with us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ethan.
Well, thank you for your important work. Now, when it comes to our relationship with nature, humans have long seen themselves as separate and superior to the natural world. We've seen centuries of development, industrialization, exploitation that have really fundamentally transformed the planet. So in that context, I wanted to begin by asking you, what is the concept of giving nature rights? Why is that important, and what does it really mean in the first place?
Yeah, well, so the rights of nature movement is often described as being a legal movement because that's where most of the action is. But it is also, you know, social and cultural. Just touching on the legal aspect, the first question a lot of people have is, why rights? How is this different than environmental law? Laws like the Clean Air Act. And you know, what people in the movement say is that rights are the highest form of protection in most legal systems. And that is a reflection of a society's values. And so, in Ecuador, for instance, where they have rights of nature in their constitution, the way that courts have applied that is making the government and companies meet a much higher standard than conventional laws. So the companies or government have to prove that their action won't irreversibly alter an ecosystem or cause species extinction. And so that's sort of the crux of it. And, you know, something to point out off the top, for some people, the idea that nature could have legal rights may sound odd, but just consider there's so many non-human entities that have legal rights in the United States. Our corporations have free speech rights that allow them to spend unlimited sums on politics. So that's a little bit of the background.
No, I think that's very helpful to put this into some context and explain how this might work a bit in practice. But how and when did this rights of nature movement start?
Yeah, so, you know, these ideas are not new. This is a way of seeing the world that indigenous communities all over the world have held on to, you know, for centuries. It started to, you know, catch on in the Western world with a 1970 or 71 law review article by a law professor named Christopher Stone called "Should Trees Have Standing?" And he wrote that to argue to the Supreme Court, which was hearing a case involving this issue, that nature should have legal standing, should have rights. And then really the first sort of Western law to take hold was actually in a rural Pennsylvania town, what would now be Trump country, in 2006, and it was sort of a reaction to just mass pollution that corporations were dumping on the town. And then ever since then, these laws and expressions have proliferated. There's more than 400 variations worldwide now, and many are non-binding, but many are also binding law.
And if you can characterize it, what would you say would be the mission or maybe common goals of this movement as you've seen them expressed in all these different contexts?
Yeah, so from a legal standpoint, it is to change the approach to protecting nature. So changing it from looking at like piecemeal regulations that just regulate the pace and amount of pollution into the air or into the water under separate laws, and looking at ecosystems more holistically, thinking about, we need to act with precaution. We don't know exactly what all of these human activities combine to do to irreversibly alter the ecosystem. So it's taking a more precautionary approach to make sure that we prove that whatever we will do will not, prevent a forest from regenerating. Culturally, sort of the bigger picture here is stepping back and saying the way that we've been thinking about nature and humanity's place in it for hundreds of years has been flawed. We are not something that's separate from nature. We're not superior to it. We come from it. We are entirely reliant upon it. We share most of our DNA with other living things. We will not survive if we don't have clean water. And the movement is kind of using the law to shift our thinking about that.
Well, we're speaking with Katie Surma, reporter at Inside Climate News, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization, and we're talking about this growing movement for the rights of nature and what that could mean in practice. And I want to open up the phone lines now. We would love to invite you, our listeners, to call in, and we would love to ask and love to hear from you in terms of your relationship with nature. Where do you see the rights of nature potentially fitting in your community and in some of the challenges politically and otherwise that our communities face when it comes to preserving and protecting our natural environment? The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email with any questions you have about the rights of nature and how it might play out in your own community to yourcall@kalw.org. So Katie, you gave a few examples here all the way from the nation of Ecuador to this original sort of municipal level version of it sounds like in the state of Pennsylvania. Can you give some other examples of where rights of nature is being enshrined in our legal system, both potentially here in the United States and abroad?
Yeah, sure. So, I'll start with the United States because there's an active, case going on right now. The Snohomish River Basin in Washington State, last year, voters there in a referendum voted overwhelmingly to recognize the river basin's legal rights. That's being challenged at the moment in a lawsuit, but it's very live. Outside of the United States, Panama is another big one. There's two national laws there. And what's interesting about Panama is a scientist, a marine biologist, was really instrumental in having that passed and designed the laws based on a lot of the scientific research she had done, particularly around sea turtles. Panama, one of those national laws, recognizes the rights of sea turtles. There's been a number of court decisions, Colombia, India, recognizing the rights of rivers. And indigenous peoples have played a key role in all of this. I can't emphasize that enough. One of the first rivers to have legal personhood is the Whanganui River in New Zealand. And that was based off a hard-fought battle of Maori indigenous people winning a settlement with the crown to have it established in the law, their worldview, how they see the river. I could go on. It's almost mm-hmm. If you threw a dart at a map, there is some sort of expression of rights of nature, because this is a universal thing that people who have a connection with the ecosystems where they live, that it just sort of takes its own expression all over the world.
And as I mentioned, we're seeing more scientists joining in with this movement. What is the significance of having more buy-in? Kind of what's the state of the trajectory of support for this movement?
Yeah, I mean, scientists, more and more of them are coming into it and in unique ways. I mean, a story I just published last week, there's a coalition of marine biologists and, you know, artificial intelligence experts who are decoding whale communications. And are looking at that as a way to get whales' rights recognized. And so the interesting thing about the scientist role is that many of them are collaborating with indigenous peoples, and they're sort of reaffirming what those communities have always known to be true, that we're part of nature, that all of nature is interdependent. And so those collaborations are super interesting. Scientists in a way are not, you know, they're not validating the indigenous knowledge, right? Because it's time tested, it's proved, we know it's true, but they're sort of giving extra heft to that, especially in the eyes of people in countries like the United States that put such, they put a lot of faith or see a lot of value in Western science.
And let's talk more about the indigenous roots of this movement. Of course, indigenous groups are quite diverse, and even today, the people in them are as diverse as any society. But I'm wondering if there are any sort of common themes that you can pull out from the indigenous aspect of this movement. What is that indigenous, you know, worldview, if we can distill it to some common denominator that has been so influential in this movement?
Yeah. And thank you for saying that. I mean, I never want to paint that, you know, indigenous peoples with a broad brush, some groups certainly don't feel aligned with this movement. But the main idea is that nature is alive. It's a living being. In that wetland story I wrote, I talked about this indigenous Kichwa community of Sarayaku in Ecuador. And, you know, they put together a declaration, I think it's more than two decades ago, about their living forest, how they've always seen the forest as something that's a living being, that's alive, that communicates with each other, different parts of it. And some, you know, fungi scientists went down, and these wetland scientists went down, and they studied the soil and, you know, said, yeah, like there's fungi in your soil that does communicate, that shares nutrients. And that's an example of one of those collaborations I was talking about, but it all comes back to the community's way of seeing the world. You know, with outside eyes, someone from the United States would say your forest is a collection of resources. It has timber, it has water that we can, you know, divvy up with water rights. It has wild animals that are things. And they just reject that view. And their view is more scientifically accurate than the traditional Western view.
So we're speaking with Katie Surma, who's a reporter at Inside Climate News, about this growing rights of nature movement, how it's playing out on the ground, quite literally, in terms of environmental protection and debates around conservation. And we would love to hear from you, our listeners, as well. Do you have questions about the rights of nature movement, thoughts about how it might apply in your community, or just thoughts of questions you might have in terms of your relationship with nature and what value you might see or not in terms of bestowing some legal rights onto natural systems, rivers, animals, etc. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. And if you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Call's One Planet series. So, Katie, you did mention the Ecuadorian constitution enshrining rights of nature. Can you talk a bit more about what Ecuador did, why that was so so impactful in terms of this overall movement of giving nature rights.
Yeah, sure, sure. And I mean, I would say among the constellation of developments that have happened, that has been the most important, the key one. You know, in 2008 or in the lead up to 2008, Ecuador, you know, convened a constitutional assembly to rewrite its governing charter, and indigenous people, including that Sarayaku community I mentioned, played a really big role in the assembly, in the drafting of that document. And they got recognition of nature's rights in there based on a lot of ecological principles. So, you know, the right to regenerate, that sort of thing, things that you would see in ecological science. And ever since then, I mean, there's been dozens of court cases applying this provision in practice. So Ecuador, in essence, has shown that, you know, the mousetrap works. A lot of the criticisms, you know, thrown at the movement are that, you know, this doesn't make sense. It's not practical. Ecuador has shown that it's practical, that it works. And it's also opened the imagination of people all around the world that we don't have to do things the way we have been doing it, that there is another way, that it's being, you know, it's being worked out in practice in Ecuador. And it's certainly not like an environmental, you know, oasis there. Ecuador is a huge oil producing country. It's turning to mining, and very timely, in about 2 weeks on November 16th, the country's president, who is a Trump ally, is asking the country if he can rewrite the constitution, which would most certainly strip out the rights of nature, along with some of the constitutional protections for indigenous people's rights and more direct democracy type of provisions, allowing people to, you know, have referendums on big questions in the country. So it's something to watch for sure.
Well, very timely to think that this landmark rights of nature constitutional provision could be on the chopping block here on November 16th. How likely is it for the president to win and be able to make those changes?
Oh, that's tough to say. I mean, he has tried, you know, months ago to sort of chip away at certain pro-environment things in the country, and he lost. The movements, the social movements, the indigenous movements in Ecuador are so strong. It's one of the reasons why it has the society it has now. It has rights of nature. But there is drug trafficking organizations have flooded into Ecuador in recent years. And the president is really leaning into that to say he needs certain tools to fight those drug trafficking organizations, and has sort of conflated, you know, environmental issues with that, or would sweep environmental protection issues away under the guise of national security. So it's hard to say. My sources there are very worried. This is also part of a much larger attack on environmentalists and human rights defenders in the country. The president there has criminalized a lot of the biggest indigenous and environmental groups, freezing their bank accounts, saying that they are, you know, somehow funded by drug trafficking organizations. So you can, I mean, that can give you a sense of what's happening there right now.
So we'll have to stay tuned for that election and those results. I want to go to the phone lines. We have Abigail in San Francisco dialing in. Abigail, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you. And I wanted to say also thank you to Katie and her work. And as a young child, I remember hearing on television about Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. And although the poor man had a stroke, but towards the end of his life, he was desperately fighting for to give a voice to nature, and to be the defender of the redwood trees, particularly. And just wondered if Katie was aware of all the work, and there must be some archive or something of, you know, his first approaches to giving nature a right.
Yeah, thank you, Abigail, for
that. Yeah.
Sure. No, thank you for raising that. I'm, as a law school graduate, I do recall that vaguely. Katie, do you have any sort of reporting on Justice Douglas and that sort of deeper historical roots of this movement?
Yeah, well, Abigail, you're spot on. That law review article I mentioned by Christopher Stone, in the case that law review article was trying to target, Justice William O. Douglas was the one who took it up. He was like a dissenting justice in that case, and he agreed with Christopher Stone. It's a beautiful dissent. If there are any sort of legal eagles out there, I recommend pulling it and reading it. And the case was Sierra Club versus Morton.
Yeah, well, thank you, Abigail, for that recollection and question. Now, Katie, as I think about the rights of nature and the sort of democratic context, so often in democracies, you see coalition politics is really what wins the day and what are the special interests behind any particular policy and their ability to get a coalition together. I mean, given that we're talking about, you know, entities, rivers, animals, you know, ecosystems that don't, you know, by definition have a voice in the political process on their own, what are some of the interest groups and how do those groups sort of, you know, help advance the rights of nature here so that there is a sort of army of support backing this legal entity?
Yeah, that is a great question. There's a whole constellation of nonprofits, indigenous communities, scientists who, you know, have come together to sort of ask the big question of what is in nature's interest? What does nature want? How can we be the voice for the natural world? You know, with science, that's why scientists, their role is so key, is that they're able to show sort of what limits are for an ecosystem. Through breakthroughs in neuroscience, we know that animals in particular suffer, they have anguish, you know, whales, for instance. For humans, we may, you know, think of noise just as a nuisance. Their world is sound and our ship noise is agonizing to them. So changing our perspective of nature as these, you know, nonprofits, et cetera, are doing, it helps, you know, bring nature's voice or interest to light. It's never going to be perfect, of course. You at least for now, we can't get into the head of a forest or an animal, but we can come pretty close. And so there's a lot of organizations, both global and local, all over the place.
And Katie, as we think about the big environmental challenge of our time, climate change, how do you view and how do the advocates and proponents of the rights of nature movement view this movement as potentially affecting that debate on climate change?
Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, so many people, I think, are drawn to the rights of nature movement because of climate change. It's apparent to them that what we are doing is not working, and not just climate change, right? This is like mass species extinction, that whatever we've been doing isn't working. We need a new approach. You know, one of my sources, David Gruber, who's a marine biologist, said during a talk he was giving in New York a few weeks ago, if we reduced, you know, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere tomorrow to acceptable levels, would that solve these issues that we're having? And the answer is no, because of the mindset we have towards nature, treating living things no differently than we treat a microwave or a car under the law, that we need to change our mindset. So to really solve problems like climate change, these big existential issues, we need to shift our thinking. We need to change our culture, all the way down.
And Katie, here in the United States, of course, we're dealing with a real onslaught from the Trump administration and Congress against our bedrock environmental laws, against conservation in this country. We're going to talk in our next segment about opening up oil and gas drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. How would you see this rights of nature movement potentially helping to thwart that onslaught of policy attacks from the Trump administration and its allies in Congress and in the judiciary?
Yeah, great question. I think by its nature, this movement is grassroots. It's about organizing at the local level. And, you know, ironically, right, we have a Republican administration that is all about centralizing power. They used to be the power or, you know, the party of small government. They're about asserting federal power now, centralizing power in the president. And rights of nature is about localism. It's about, you know, having a deep connection with the ecosystems where you live and protecting them, whether that's your backyard. It doesn't have to be the Amazon forest, right? And that has been the strength of the movement in places where it's been successful. In the United States, you know, perhaps, you know, we could take a page out of the book of those other groups of people like in Ecuador and look back to, you know, localism, to talking to your neighbors and organizing, potentially where a lot of success could happen.
Well, thank you so much for explaining the rights of nature movement, for your work covering this really important global story. Katie Surma, reporter at Inside Climate News, reporting focusing on international environmental law, human rights, and the environmental justice movement. Thanks so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you, Ethan.
And coming up next, we are about opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling, as I mentioned. So stay with us. We'll be back right after this short break.